Megan Nosel, and thank you for listening to this episode of the SLP Minded Podcast, the show that brings the research to the clinic. Are you SLP minded? Not sure? Do you label yourself as an SLP geek? Do you enjoy critically thinking about the research in our field? Do you have dreams of pursuing a doctorate or conducting your own research study one day? Do you enjoy talking with the researchers, seeking their insight, and hearing about their discoveries? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then the SLP Minded Podcast is definitely for you. The aims of this podcast are to encourage a stronger appreciation for research and to foster a stronger relationship between the researchers and the clinicians. By interviewing medical SLP researchers about their latest studies, discoveries, and the clinical implications of their work, we can definitely think more critically about the ways to improve our own evidence-based practices and patient outcomes. Don't forget to download this episode's references and resources page on the website for more information. Sounds easy enough, right? Sure. Sit back and enjoy this insightful conversation. Today, I'm really excited to talk with Dr. Claire Mitchell about a potentially new treatment approach for CVA-related dysarthria. Dr. Mitchell worked in England's National Health Service as an SLP for 20 years. During her time as an SLP, she was a clinician in various adult medical settings, including acute care and the community at large, but she specialized in working with stroke survivors. Shortly after receiving her master's degree in 2000, she worked as a clinical lecturer at the University of Manchester and maintained her clinical skills as a part-time SLP in order to conduct clinical research on dysarthria after stroke. At that time, she felt dysarthria was a neglected area of SLP research compared to the amount of research devoted to aphasia. Through her early research, she realized the importance of listening to and actively engaging the patient's voice, which is where her idea for using technology as a means of supportive speech rehabilitation came to focus. She was awarded a prestigious National Institute for Health Research Fellowship to obtain her PhD and to conduct research in order to evaluate the use of an online program targeting dysarthria. Dr. Mitchell will be discussing her research on ready speech for people with dysarthria after stroke, her feasibility randomized controlled study, what she has discovered in her research, the importance of having the patient voice involved in research, and where she would like the research to go next. We also talk about the clinical implications of her research and examine evidence-based practices in dysarthria treatment today. Can you give us a little intro about your ready speech, how it came in your mind, and who created it, and what does it stand for even? I'm interested in knowing, you know, why certain letters are capitalized and yes, some are not.
Absolutely. So just to give you a bit of background, I was working in stroke in a community setting, and I would go and see patients at various locations, and they would say to me, have you got anything else that we could use so we could practice exercises when you're not here for homework? And I would give them often pieces of paper that were kind of photocopied and looked a bit shabby. And it really made me think, actually, we should be harnessing some of this technology that's out there and making things better so people can be reminded of what they're supposed to be doing, and they can have just sort of reminders really of what their exercises are supposed to be. So I went through quite a long process of kind of looking at various sort of technology options. The ready speech really stands for rehabilitation of dysarthric speech, hence the capitalizations in various places. And this was something that we developed alongside our patient research advisors, fellow speech and language therapists, just to try and come up with quite a basic exercise program that was online.
So was it like focus group driven? Did you have focus groups?
Yes, absolutely. So I think the thing with the research is that it really takes such a long time. So this was a good many years ago before I started my PhD that I did some little interviews with patients. I did some little mini focus groups with SLPs and did quite a lot of development work, really trying to find out what might be practical, trying to cover acute services and community services. So, you know, there was a lot of sort of preparation work, I guess, going on in the background.
I can imagine. Dysarthria is so tricky.
to treat. It's like one of those things that, you know, when someone comes in, and I see clients with dysarthria all the time, and it's just one of the many things I feel kind of underprepared in treating. And I'm reading about it, and I'm learning as much as I can, and I do some experimentation, really. And I'm really excited just that there might be something else we can do. And so it's for like pretty much the full spectrum of patients.
Yes. I mean, I suppose I really need to sort of say that I guess in the process of doing the research, I feel that I know even less about dysarthria than I did at the beginning.
Well, that makes me feel a little better.
So it's you're right. It's one of those topics that I think the lack of research means we do as clinicians feel really quite in the dark, I guess, about what the best approach is, what we should be saying to people. And I guess this research that I've done has just made me think we need to do so much more, because, you know, it's even things like frequency. How often should we be saying to people they need to be doing practice? And we don't have any real understanding of what works best for different types of dysarthria, and at what point after stroke should we be doing it at different intensities. So I feel that it's very understandable that people don't always know what they should be saying to people, and there's still a lot more to do, really.
Yeah, I wonder why the researchers shy away from this area. You know, why, you know, I really liked that you said in your bio that it's really under researched. And why is that? You know, it's really such a common problem in stroke. And, you know, why are we shying away from it? Do you have any ideas about that?
Do you know, I've thought long and hard about that query, because it's something that as a clinician, I guess it prompted me to start doing research more and more seriously in a way, because I think I was going out doing these community visits thinking, wow, I'm still doing the same thing with people that I did 20 years ago when I graduated. And I just kind of kept thinking, I can't believe that we don't know anymore 20 years down the line. So it then was a little moment of realization when I thought, well, I guess maybe I should do something and start looking into it, because, you know, we haven't got the information really that we need as clinicians. So that really was quite a big prompt for me. And like I say, I don't feel I've necessarily made any great inroads on that, but I feel it's a start. And I feel that certainly in the UK, some of the work that I've done with my patient research advisors has really started to highlight dysarthria, and it's really becoming something that people are talking about a little bit more, which I feel is a really powerful impact from the research. And it might not be giving us the evidence that we need at the moment, but it's a starting point. And I just wonder if it's worth sort of talking about the fact that I did a Cochrane review as part of my research. And as part of that Cochrane review, as well as highlighting the lack of research, and certainly when you compare that to the aphasia Cochrane review, there's a real difference. But I did some really nice work around blogs with a really talented research advisor that I had who's got dysarthria after stroke. And that blog was really kind of well received and shared quite widely on social media and on Twitter. And I felt that I had quite a lot of response from both SLPs and also big charitable funding bodies in England. So that was a really nice way of trying to highlight the importance of dysarthria and the impact it has on individuals.
That is fantastic. What is that blog?
So I should really send you the link to that blog, shouldn't I?
But it's, yes, please.
Yeah, so it's part. So Cochrane do blogs, and they call it Evidently Cochrane. And it's a way of trying to make the sometimes quite dry matter involved in a Cochrane review sort of more accessible, understandable to both patients and healthcare professionals as well. So I'll
Wow, I didn't know about that. That's fantastic.
So I will happily send you the link to that, because it led to some more blogging that Cochrane did as a campaign in England. So I'll certainly send you the link for you to have a read of that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So returning to the software, or I think it's software. Is this correct, or is it an app?
It is soft. It's an online web-based program.
Okay. So is it a form of visual and auditory biofeedback? What is the premise of it?
It's probably not quite as, responsive as I would like it to be. So we had a very limited funding base to develop it. So all it is at the moment is an online program that is specific to each individual. So you put your the patient that you're working with, you put their name in, and you go through the different sections and you pull out sets of exercises that are relevant for them. So they will have, for example, if you felt they needed to do some articulation work, you would choose what sounds you wanted them to practice on in whatever position, and words appear on screen for them to practice and self-monitor. So we kind of had on it articulation, breathing, facial expression, intonation, and oromotor exercises. So those were the kind of basic categories that we went for. So we set up the program, and in a way it was just a different way of presenting what we would do with people. So it wasn't particularly responsive, but it was quite basic and simple and easy for people to use. So the research then went down the road of, was it actually feasible to use this online program with people after stroke? So could we get people using it? And I guess in the future going forward, it certainly makes me realize how I would like it to be in the future. So as you say, much more around visual and auditory biofeedback. But at the moment, we were just finding out, could we carry out a research study that recruited people to use an online program after stroke? A lot of people felt that because of the older age group, people wouldn't be very willing to engage with it. So it's a very, I feel when I describe it to people, it seems such a slow process that we had to start with a feasibility trial to say, was it feasible to use this technology, to run the trial, to recruit people, to retain them? And then that would enable us to make any changes that we needed, such as improving the technology. And then going forward, we could then look to justify the expense of a big randomized control trial.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you designed the feasibility work going into it? You made some very interesting choices in how to actually carry out the research.
Absolutely. I think the interesting thing about doing research is that you realize there are many, many ways to do many, many projects, and you kind of have to, in the end, make a choice about what you feel will work pragmatically, I guess. So we set up a trial, a feasibility trial, and it was a randomized control trial. So people either had usual care, or they had usual care and access to the online Ready Speech program.
That. Yeah, that's
so that's how we did it. So it's, as you say, it's impossible pretty much in a rehabilitation trial to blind the participants to the intervention that they're getting. So we had to be upfront with people that these were the possible therapy choices that they would randomly be allocated to. And like any randomized control trial, we weren't saying that either was better than the other, which is absolutely the truth. We don't know which is better. The difficulty when you do any kind of randomized trial is that people have their own opinions. And actually, participants who are randomized to the technology arm really felt like they'd won the lottery. They felt that was a real kind of bonus for them. So that's problematic because obviously, you know, this wasn't looking at the outcome of the intervention because it wasn't a powered big trial, but that's going to have an impact. Going forward, that's going to have an impact because people are feeling that's a better thing to have already. Interestingly, even the people that didn't use the program very often at all still felt very happy that they'd got access to it, whether they used it or not. So, you know, very useful lesson for us going forward.
Like going forward, have you thought about a sham?
It's very difficult. I mean, I obviously I've thought of all sorts of options, and I think it's quite difficult to do a sham alternative in a way, because they will know that the sham isn't working on their speech. Which obviously, I think there are, I know there are many different studies. And one study that I know about used a kind of alternative control arm where people used a technology program but did puzzles and word searches and things like that. I suppose the alternative that maybe could be used is the one that they sometimes call a waiting list control arm. So where people are told, if you don't get randomized to the technology arm, initially, once the trial is finished, you will then get access to it. So it kind of takes away the feeling that they haven't got the best result, but it just means that they'll get it anyway. So sometimes that can be a way of getting around it.
That's so tricky. It's a placebo effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, which is powerful.
Very, very powerful. It's very interesting. Yeah. So how did you recruit SLPs and stroke patients to do the study?
We have obviously a good network where we are in the northwest of England. We've got two kind of major cities. We've got Manchester and Liverpool. And we have a strong network of SLPs who are very interested in getting involved in research and were very much on board. We have clinical excellence networks where we meet. Obviously, geographically, we're all fairly close together, which is very different for you guys.
Yes.
But people were hearing about the research from a very early point and very keen to get involved in the research. And actually, I would say really embraced getting involved. Again, so it was the therapists working clinically, the SLPs, who would refer patients into the trial. So I would then go to wherever they were and recruit those individuals. So I guess the biggest problem is reminding SLPs, busy clinicians, to keep referring people into the study, basically. So obviously they've got other priorities, and it was just making sure that people were remembering.
That's a really good point. You know, you have half hour, 45 minutes to talk to a patient and work with them. And, you know, I wonder what can be done to make it a little easier for clinicians to refer. You have any thoughts on that?
Oh, it's a good point. You almost feel that people need a checklist of potential research studies.
Right.
And I guess the other thing is that there's some research evidence that shows that people, this may be particular to the UK, but people that are involved in research have better outcomes whether they get involved in the intervention arm or the control arm. They just do better generally. That it's sort of posed that it might be because they have more checks and more support because they are involved in this trial and people are engaging with them a lot more. But I think that's
a really good point.
Yeah. And I think it's really good to remind therapists of that. So it can actually be in the patient's best interest to be involved in a trial and get involved in research, that they can sometimes do really well just by the pure fact of being involved.
Do you have that research? I'm writing myself a note.
Absolutely. I can send you a link to that research.
That's a really great incentivizing thing to remember. When we send out emails inviting referrals, maybe we should include that. Research shows that patients, you know, and we all want to have better patient outcomes. So I would see that as a huge bump in your favor.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, I think sometimes as therapists, we can be a little bit protective almost of our patients, and maybe we kind of can sometimes make decisions a little bit on their behalf. Or I know therapists would say to me, oh, I didn't think about this person because I just felt that maybe the timing wasn't right for them.
Right.
And I think it's this has certainly made me realize that actually we have to give people the options and the opportunities for them to make those decisions for themselves in a way. So I think that's been quite a useful learning for me anyway.
That's a good point. I love that. I'm going to remember that myself. Well, we talked a little bit about this, the placebo effect in your study, but how do you ensure that SLPs are objective? And we've already kind of hit on, you know, well, there's a little bit of a placebo effect and maybe you have to work that out in the future, or, you know, maybe you have already, but what about with SLPs?
Yeah, so I think this is where you're talking about is part of a research protocol. Are they all doing the same thing? Because obviously we had sort of, I guess, 40 people in the trial, and the people that were in the control arm, as well as the intervention arm, you'd sort of want to be able to compare what they were getting, what treatment. For this trial, with it being feasibility, we took a quite a pragmatic overview, actually. So we very much left it up to therapists to do what they felt was clinically appropriate with people. So we weren't particularly prescriptive about what they offered. And then afterwards, we were able to work out what intervention people had had. So we went through the case notes and extracted that data and what the content was. And from the program, the online program, we could see what interactions people had had with it, what exercises had been set for them, and what exercises the individuals had done on the program.
Okay.
So we did it in a slightly different way. So we didn't set out and say, you must do this, that, or the other, but we said, do what you think is right, and we'll have a look at it afterwards.
Okay, interesting.
Yes. So again, it has its advantages and disadvantages, but with it being a feasibility trial, I think that's a fair enough approach, I guess. What we actually found in the trial was that the intervention and control arm looked quite similar. So going forward to a bigger trial, we would need to have a look at that, because they were almost the amount of time and the content was almost too similar. So you wouldn't be able to see a difference between the two. We'd have to be very clear what we were looking to find.
Interesting. So what are your thoughts on how you would do that in the future? Like, how will you give specific instructions on what techniques they can use?
Yes. I mean, that very much needs to be worked through. I guess it's thinking about, are we saying for a future trial, would we be looking at no intervention versus usual care and online access? So, you know, are we saying that, are we looking at natural recovery of dysarthria after stroke versus can we really enhance that and improve it by offering intervention? So that's one possibility.
Okay.
Or we could be very much doing, again, a trial where people don't get any intervention and then get intervention, and we have two different groups swapping over. So people start with intervention and then have no intervention. So there's lots of ways.
Boy.
Yeah, there are lots of ways that could be done. And I think it's you know, I think that's something that we really need to tease out what we're trying to look at, what we're trying to find. And I think that's the time when we would start being more protocol driven. So saying to people what we were expecting them to do.
Okay.
I guess the other real issue that I'm interested in is around intensity.
Yeah.
And I would hope going forward, bigger trial, that we could start to look more at intensity. So whether we had a no intervention group, a low intensity group, and a high intensity group. So those are the possible options that I'm mulling over in my mind, but haven't really got clear yet going forward, because I feel that what we offer now and seeing what was offered as part of this trial is probably not enough to make a difference to people. I feel there's something about how long we offer therapy for and how intense that is.
Okay.
And because we don't have the evidence, I would say we're pretty relaxed about how often we expect people to do their exercises, and it's fairly random what we say to people. And I think there needs to be more work done around, you know, we need to be able to say to people, for this to make a difference to your speech and your intelligibility, you need to be at this many weeks post-stroke, doing your therapy this many times a day for this number of weeks. And I feel, you know, this is my kind of future ambition, 20 years down the line, I would imagine, but we need to find out that information about, you know, what we're saying to people about how they present, what they should be doing, and what their best outcome will be.
I mean, it's a neurorehabilitative approach. You know, I think that we're seeing it more in dysphagia.
Yeah.
That we know that in people who have dysphagia after stroke, we need intense programs, exercise programs. So why would it be any different for dysarthria? This is what my thought is. So
yeah.
But, you know, the one challenge I have with clients who have dysarthria is I actually do use a little bit of technology. I use speech dictation software.
Yeah.
And which can be very frustrating, but I tell them that at first it's not about your percentage. Just try to identify the strategies that work for you. See where you make an improvement. And if you go slow, does that make an improvement in your speech intelligibility? If you take frequent pauses or if you over-articulate, does that make a difference? And giving them that visual feedback is something that I see. More people are motivated to do that kind of work rather than, okay, here's a paper with sentences and I want you to go practice in front of the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
There's no feedback.
Yeah.
And even if someone was listening to critique you, you will get all kinds of critiques. People will miss it because your brain just automatically fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
So that's why when I read your article, I thought, this is what I'm waiting for. And I wondered, gosh, I really want to talk to you because this, I think technology is motivating to people. And I think the reason why people love technology is because there's so much feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel that when I go and talk to my fellow SLPs at various forums, I feel that I wish I had for them the perfect software that would do all these things. And I think that in a way, what we've found is that people are really willing to engage with technology. And I think some of the feedback I had from the people that were involved in developing it, it was very much about they were able to go to a quiet room on their own and make mistakes and not feel embarrassed in front of, you know, their therapist or their friends and family, and kind of take their time to work out all those things that you say that are very person-centered about what works best for you. Is it slowing your rate of speech? Is it over-articulation? And you're right, I think that there are different things around like dictation software, and I feel that we need something that pulls all these things together, that's user-friendly, it gives feedback, and sort of, certainly offers people a very individualized program so that they can move more quickly, do more practice, and all those things. And I feel that's a big part of it. And I think that almost that is the next stage of the research to have that. But what our research has found, although what we used wasn't all singing and all dancing, it was very basic, but what it did find is that people, we could do a big trial. We could do a big trial of technology for people with dysarthria after stroke. And it might seem that it's, 3 years of my PhD to find that out, but that's a really important starting point that we know that we can recruit people and we can, in the future, start to do a big trial to look at effectiveness of that type of intervention. And then that is, again, it's kind of building blocks to help us then find out, well, what works best for different people at different time points after stroke. And then we have the intensity and how long issues. So I feel it's very much a lot of preparation work. And although I can't turn around to my fellow clinicians and say, I have this amazing software that's going to be the answer to all your questions, it's a slowly evolving process, I guess.
Well, in your work, have you found any certain techniques to be, I mean, have you seen patterns in what does work?
Well, I suppose we're sort of talking in terms of, is it best to be working at impairment level where you kind of are getting people to do their exercises, or is it more an activity level where you're trying to support people to use strategies? And then, you know, are people able to use those strategies in their everyday life? So I guess, you know, all I would say from the evidence that we've got and from clinical practice and expert practice, I would say it's very much about how you described before, that you engage with the individual to work out what works best for them. Everybody presents, as you know, so differently. And it's really about finding what works best for people. And I think it's very interesting that, you know, we have our views on what we think works, and it's patients don't always want to do what you might expect them to want to do. And sometimes people really like doing some very simple repetitive exercises, or some people might just want to get straight out there and start talking. So I just think we just carry on as we are expert at doing, as being very person-centered, and work with the tools that we have available to us. And as you say, trying to embrace whatever technology tools we've got, and working with individuals, I guess, in that way.
From your Cochrane review, what did you find? I can imagine what you found.
But
I'd love to hear what you found.
Yeah, absolutely. So doing the Cochrane review was an amazing experience, actually. It's something that I felt before I set out quite daunted by. Obviously, I knew the high regard that Cochrane was held in worldwide, but it was something that I felt, it seemed a very scary prospect, and actually the process of it was much more enjoyable. So I wanted this to be a very global review, so I really wanted to kind of search worldwide for any possible research study that had found an effect in working with people with dysarthria. So a previous dysarthria Cochrane review many years previously had found no studies suitable for inclusion. We went more broadly with the title, and we found 5 trials that could be included. So, yeah, so it's that for a Cochrane review is really tiny. So
it sounds like a very time consuming process.
Yes, hugely time consuming. And, you know, in some ways, only having 5 is so small. Some of the other big Cochrane reviews have thousands of studies.
Yeah.
So once you have your studies, you then look at them in great detail and you really start looking into exactly what was done. If there was any concerns about bias in terms of what they did, in terms of how people were randomized, you then look in great detail to see, could you actually replicate the study? Is there enough detail for you? So all that is very interesting. And, you know, from the five studies that we included, two we felt were free from bias. So three of those studies had concerns around possible bias around how the study was carried out. So that makes you think that some of those studies don't then tell you an awful lot. So we also found that all of them were very small. They were had very small populations, and none of them were powered. So none of them were powered to look at effectiveness of the intervention. And we're at the end, we have five studies, and really none of them are really telling us anything more than what we already know.
That's so disappointing.
Disappointing.
Well, the two that you found that were, you know, the least biased.
Yeah.
And what did they reveal about what is most evidence-based that we have?
Well, again, it's really difficult to say that they revealed anything. I'm sorry to tell you, I don't think there's any great sort of revealing insight from either of those two studies. And I suppose one of the other issues that became really apparent is that they all had different outcome measures at different time points. And again, that's really problematic in research. So let's just say we had the five original papers, and between them, they had about 10 outcome measures, and not one of them had used the same outcome measure as the other. So, yeah, so I guess, although disappointingly in terms of us as clinicians, the Cochrane Review didn't tell us what would or wouldn't work with people. In fact, the jury's out. There's not enough evidence to say any of it works or any of it doesn't work. But what it does tell us is that we need to get some agreed outcome measures globally, worldwide, of what we think are good measures of dysarthria. And we need to have properly powered, properly methodologically sound research trials going on into dysarthria to give us the answers that we want. So,
well, I mean, that's the purpose of research, narrowing down, I suppose. And unfortunately, it's not always going to have a happy ending.
No.
But it does give you some direction, absolutely, like you said, on where we need to go.
Yeah.
So that's very important. That's just as important as finding some little golden nuggets of information,
absolutely,
I guess.
Absolutely. And I think, as you say, you have to take research, you know, it doesn't always deliver what you want it to deliver.
Yeah.
And you have to take the best of it, I guess, and work with that. And I think it certainly gives a lot of direction going forward.
Okay. Do you think your Ready Speech software program will be used with a particular kind of dysarthria? Did you find a pattern in the kinds of patients you recruited for it? Like, was it flaccid or spastic or?
Not particularly. No, not particularly. There didn't seem to be any great pattern. And I think, again, that's probably something that would benefit from more research. I would say really that everybody had all sorts of different presentations as part of the trial. And I guess people took different aspects of the program that were most relevant to them. And obviously that was judged by their treating therapist. So I guess that's something that I feel has the potential to be delved into more going forward.
Why did you choose these assessments? If you could talk about that for a minute. I'm not familiar with the TOMS. I am familiar with the Dysarthria Impact Profile, and I love the Speech Handicap Index. That's the SHI is what I use. I love that. But that's mostly quality of life, and I do think that it's an important perspective to have, you know, how is it impacting the patient and is it getting better from their perspective? Maybe not objectively, because we don't have a whole lot, I think, at our disposal for that. But I just was curious about why you chose the assessments you chose.
Absolutely. I think it's a really important issue. And going back to my point about the Cochrane, about this variety of outcome measures that are used in research, we need to have some decisions really going forward about what we need to be using to measure different aspects. And as you say, the patient voice and their opinion is hugely important. But you'll notice I didn't use the voice handicap index. I used another measure that had been developed in Manchester, actually. And I used that because it was developed for aphasia work predominantly, but had also been used with dysarthria. And because there's so much co-occurrence of dysarthria and aphasia, that guided me to use that aphasia friendly, but it's very much a patient reported measure of their speech. So, and I think that's hugely important. You're right, we don't have huge numbers of assessments at our fingertips for dysarthria. And I guess I was a little bit bound by what I knew and used clinically. So I use the French A because that's something that I would use clinically. But that's a measure of impairment, and it's the therapist's measure of the individual's impairment. So it's almost when we're talking about outcome measures and going forward, this is a topic that I'm really interested in. We need to talk about having different measures for different things. So we need an impairment measure. We need a measure of activity, and we need a measure of participation, so that the patient's view of their communication in everyday life. So I also use the TOMS, which is the therapy outcome measure. And this is really widely used in the UK, and I think they use it in Australia.
Is that available to most clinicians? Is it something you pay for? I didn't even see where you get it.
Okay. So it is a published assessment, and you can get it online, but I guess it was developed in the UK. And it's considered quite a quick and easy measure. And for that, it's widely used, I guess. So again, I use that because it's got some nice evidence around it. It's also widely used clinically, and it's quick. So because of this being a feasibility trial, we were looking at the feasibility of these measures. So how long it took to run through them with people, what they thought of them in terms of did they think they were representative of their speech, etc. Interestingly, the dysarthria impact profile, which was developed for people with dysarthria in more progressive conditions, and more, it was devised for people that were more around 6 months plus post dysarthria. We found that was not feasible to use as part of this trial. So there were issues around it in terms of my stroke advisory group felt that some of the questions were quite complex. And because we recruited a lot of people who were in the acute phase of stroke, a lot of the questions weren't relevant to them because they were much more around their interaction at home, about using the phone, and these were people that were potentially inpatients at the time. So actually, we, even though that was in the protocol, in the information about the published trial, we had to make it quite clear that even though we planned on using it, we then didn't use it because it wasn't feasible.
Okay. Well, so do you think you're going to use the TOMS and then the French A only going forward?
I would also say that our measure that we used, it's a measure that is called the COAST. So that was the measure looking at the patient perception of their communication. We would use that as well. I have to say, I would say it would probably be a bit hasty at the moment for me to say what I would use going forward, because I would really like to do some work, and I would hope this would be global work with fellow clinicians globally, researchers and patients, to decide and come up with some sort of consensus about what outcome measures we should be using at what time points, so that we have some sort of consensus for anyone doing disaster research to use the same measures, so we can all be using the same information. And then when it comes to meta-analysis, like as part of a Cochrane review, the data will be more powerful because we will be able to say everybody's used this measure at this time point, and we can amalgamate findings to be more powerful.
That would be great. I would love to see the findings on that one.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Well, is there any chance you could tell me where I can get the TOMS, or you can send me a link? Because I looked, but I couldn't find it, and I'd like to see it. And the COAST, I don't know that one either. It's just nice to kind of look at these and compare to what you have. And my go-to is the French A and the speech handicap index.
Yes, yeah, and so. I think they're, you know, I'm sure they're, you know, pretty valid and have their, you know, have their bonuses. I feel that with any, you know, measure, as you all well know, they all have their pros and cons, don't they?
I know.
So, yeah, so absolutely. But I'm more than happy. So I have a little list of things, links to send you.
I'll send you the list so you don't have to worry.
Okay, great, great.
How is the study going?
Yes, the study has finished. So we published the study in a journal, I think at the very start of this year. And in fact, the final outcome of the trial was really, as I've described before, that it was feasible to carry out. So patients after stroke, even in the very acute stage, were very willing to get involved in a research trial that was using technology. And I think that we had a lot of people before saying that they weren't sure if that would be the case, if people were not in the right demographic in terms of age, that they might not be willing to engage with technology. But I'll give you one example of a lady who was in her 90s and was in an acute ward environment, was really willing to get involved in the research. People are hugely altruistic a lot of the time. She said, if this will help other people, I'm really happy to get involved. And when I went to see her at the end, so I carry out my follow-up outcome measures, and then I decide what treatments people had, and then I find out what treatment they did actually have. So when I was talking to this lady in her 90s, I said to her, I'm guessing that you had your therapy, that you had pieces of paper to practice your exercises with. And she said, no, I didn't. She said, I had somebody come to see me and they bought me a glass book. It was this book made of glass, and they swooshed it. They swooshed it across, and words appeared, and there were videos.
Oh my
goodness. You know, so there was this lady who'd never seen an iPad before. And this is how she was describing her intervention. So I think, you know, it was really enlightening for me to think, actually, we shouldn't be imposing barriers on technology due to age. People with the right support are quite happy to engage with technology. So that was a great finding.
Wow.
So we found that people, we could recruit them. We found that we could randomize them, that people really didn't mind about being randomized, although they were very happy to get the technology arm. People would say, I don't mind if I don't get the other arm, because we understand that's how research works. We have to be randomized. So that was a great outcome. And then we found that we could retain people in the trial. When we came to follow people up, we had a really high retention rate. So again, those are all really positive aspects going forward to a much bigger trial, that we can show that we've got some good evidence that this would be a worthwhile project to do.
That is fantastic. I'm really excited about that. So you think that maybe the actual having the technology increased compliance with home exercises, and it was a positive impact compared to patients who didn't have the technology?
Yes, I mean, obviously I have to be very wary because this trial, it wasn't powered to look at any sort of effect. But
I understand.
Yes, we found that particularly the people in the community, so people who were back at home, were much more likely to independently use the technology program and do home exercise more often than people who had paper-based exercises. So I think
that's promising.
That is promising. And I think that's, you know, the proviso with all of this is that I can't state any great claims, but I think it's really promising about offering people, and I feel it's that's what it's about really, offering people something better and something more engaging than what we've currently got.
Yes. And I don't know about how the listeners view this or what their experiences are, but personally, when I give them pre-treatment education about, okay, here's this is what it's going to look like, and, you know, we're going to start off, you know, perhaps with some paper-based exercises, the second I move to speech dictation software is when I see a massive jump in exercise compliance, as well as patients' active participation, and they're not forgetting to do their home therapy work anymore. They're engaged. And so I'm really hoping this will be more effective than what we have used in the past, you know, traditional dysarthria treatment.
Absolutely. And I think there is something around, this is the feedback that I've had from my patient research advisory groups, there's something around showing that this is important enough that these programs have been developed for people with this condition, which lends it more a sense of importance. And I think that people really respond to that. They don't think, oh, I'm kind of wasting people's time. I just need to get on with this. I should be grateful for how I am. And I think there is something around that sense of importance that's really powerful for people.
Yeah, I agree. So besides funding, and maybe it doesn't sound like recruiting patients and SLPs were much of a hurdle, but was there any big hurdle in this research that you found?
Yes, I think that's a really good question. And it's one, I think you're right. I mean, I think anything around funding, that's obviously a challenge. And I think that's a challenge that everybody has. I would say that it's more about trials go on for a long time. This trial went on for 18 months. And I think it's really trying to remind therapists that the trial is still going on. You still want them to be recruiting for you. You know, people are busy. They have other priorities. And it's just trying to keep flagging that up with people without being a nuisance and putting them off referring at all. So I guess if I were to say anything being a hurdle, I would say it is recruitment and keeping that high on people's agenda.
That is so important to note, because I think this is kind of one of the purposes of my podcast, that I really want to develop more of a relationship with the researchers, because I think we need each other.
Yeah.
We can't have the research if the clinicians aren't on board.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the researchers aren't willing to work with the clinicians, I mean, where are we headed?
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, and for future SLP researchers listening to the podcast who perhaps are kind of throwing around the idea of getting a PhD and maybe even participating in the research out there, can you tell us any important insights that you've learned over the years as a researcher, or something we should keep in mind besides being open to making sure we get patients involved in research and that we're helping as much as possible?
I think, I guess this won't be a surprise to clinicians or fellow researchers, but I think perseverance has been the biggest factor for me, that I think you can't imagine how long these things take sometimes. And I almost feel that you could potentially be put off very early on if you really knew how long things took. But I think if you feel strongly, if you believe that you're doing the best thing for the people that you're working with, that really helps you to persevere. And, you know, really, I don't think any challenge is completely insurmountable. I think that you can chip away at anything, and I guess just keep plugging away. And I suppose it's almost not to be thinking that you're going to change the world overnight, because I think you very quickly realize, you know, as we've discussed today, that things are so slow and changing things can take so long. But you have to start with those stepping stones, and you have to believe that just by achieving those can either make the next bit of research easier for you or somebody else, and everything you're building on is all going towards the same cause. So I really feel that perseverance, don't be put off. If your first bit of funding doesn't come off or your first application gets rejected, you know, you look around to some really big, famous top researchers and they all have rejections, and it's a case of that resilience and persevering. And I think the thing that motivated me, I guess, through this whole process has been working with patients to develop the research. You know, that's a really powerful part of the research now, that you're not, it's not just about your recruits in the research, it's about the people that you work with to set up the research and to get them on board with the design and the methodology and the patient information sheets and all that side of things. And they can really keep you going because they're the people that it really affects and has an impact on their everyday life. And I guess if you have that motivation, you then persevere.
You are a living model. I am just so honored to have talked to you. And I mean, I think the work that you're doing is great, and I'm so appreciative. I can probably say that for other clinicians as well, because treating dysarthria is a real challenge. So I just want to thank you for the work that you're doing and the perseverance that you have shown over the years. You just keep going towards your goal. And so you're a gem in our field.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. So many thanks for that. And I'm kind of hopeful that some of the work that I've done has inspired fellow SLPs in England to start doing master's projects. People that have heard me talk with one of my patient advisors at a conference, people have then contacted me to say, I now want to get involved in doing dysarthria research. So I really hope that it can build a community, you know, people like yourself who are baffled by what we do with people with dysarthria, you know, like I am clinically as well. And if we all start to highlight the topic and work together to promote it, I think that's a really important part of making things better as we carry on.
I agree. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for talking to me and hearing about the research.
I'll look forward to any other work that you put out. I'll be looking.
Lovely. Thank you.
The lively theme music for the SLP Minded podcast was written by my fellow SLP and good friend, Justin Berry. Thank you so much for providing us your musical talent and creativity, Justin. You rock. And thanks everyone for listening to today's show.